Hi, this is Chico Matsusaka, and welcome to Mission Artist. Today, I'm talking with fellow orchestral musician and American Federation of Musicians negotiator, Adam DeSorgo. Adam and I have been friends for quite a few years. We both joined the Sarasota Orchestra around the same time. But a few years ago, Adam was diagnosed with Meniere's disease, a disorder of the inner ear that can lead to dizzy spells, tinnitus, and hearing loss. It's considered a rare chronic condition that occurs in adulthood, and while there are various treatments to help relieve some of the symptoms, for a musician this can be professionally devastating, and this was the case for Adam. It was a wildfire that burned through his personal life as well, but he persisted. Adam did not let himself be defined by the disease or by the loss of a job title. Instead, he allowed himself to be defined by his response to his newfound situation. By the time the pandemic rolled in, Adam had relocated to Chicago with his husband Samus and was looking to restart and perhaps reinvent a new phase in his life. We had kept in touch during the move and more so during the shutdown, so I wanted to talk to him about the pandemic, how he coped, and its impact on his experience with Meniere's.
I'd say it's certainly true, with the caveat that I think there is a point at which when people are dealt something traumatic that they can't control in one way or another, you know, nobody has a perfect way through in the beginning. And so coming to I don't even want to say the other side, because it isn't a, like, I don't, because I think it's a process. Like, I don't think you can kind of like come out on the other side and you're like, duh, you know, like, it's the light at the end of the tunnel, proverbially. And yeah, I just don't think that's a thing. I think it's, at least in this context, I think it's more of a process. And there's always one an unfairness that happens, even when you've maybe worked through larger problems, you know, then something else like happens. One of the people that really helped me through the beginning of it, and I was a bass player in Rochester named Galen McCormick. I met her during the time that I played in Rochester. I was there for an extended trial that took, it was like six concerts for the seasons that they weren't consecutive. Anyway, so I got to know her really well back then. That was like 2006. Mm-hmm. And so when she went public with it on Facebook, I reached out to her and I said, you know what, I'm dealing with these issues too. My particular, I should also just qualify that my audiologist, who's wonderful, Heather Malyuk, who is works with a lot of musicians, classical musicians and other musicians too, of other genres, I should say. She calls Meniere's the autism of the hearing world because of how sort of elusive it is in terms of a cause and a remedy. You know, it's sort of kind of trying a bunch of different stuff because no one is really clear what causes it. Galen's experience was much different than mine, and hers was a lot worse. And mine, I was lucky in that it kind of, at least for the time being, has petered out at this point where I have like roughly 50%, between 50 and 60% loss, mm-hmm. and it doesn't seem to be getting worse. So that's, you know, good news. And I guess if I were to get specific about the pandemic, was that I felt like I had this time to kind of go, all right, maybe have/had absolute pitch. And so I spent some time doing a bit of retraining, like, okay, well, this is where C is now. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where A is now. And so it, in some ways it was like, okay, I'm slowly bringing people in to kind of play with other people to see whether that ended up working and whether I still had the ability to make adjustments and dipping my toes back into playing little by little. I'm done with auditions. Obviously I'm done with, you know, I don't intend on like having an orchestra job, but I'm really fortunate that I have friends who keep me on their sub lists and that I have opportunities to go in, and that there's essentially a bit of a place in which people are able to say, no, this sounds that you're, it's fine. Everything's fine. And most recently I played a week in the Kansas City Symphony in which I played English horn, which involved a lot of solos that I hadn't, that was a hot seat I hadn't been on for a while since essentially 2018. And I was like, all right, well, this is going to be interesting. And so it ended up feeling good and like, okay, this is something that I can do. And it's not something, again, that I feel like I'm going to be going to now take English horn auditions. Like, that's not what this is about. But it's just a sense of, like, I can occasionally still have this creative outlet, and I'm grateful that it's there, you know. And I, with the understanding, of course, that with as wacky as this disease is, it may not be.
As long as I've known Adam, he's always been an advocate for better working conditions, not just in the orchestra world, but in all aspects of the labor movement. He's always been willing to run headlong into conflict, but what I feel sets him apart is his openness and ability to consider both sides. This could make him unpopular at times because he can't be pinned down or relied to be absolute on a particular issue. Regardless of these moments of friction, Adam manages to stay true in remaining open. I asked Adam to reflect on this and if the pandemic has made an impact on his views.
In terms of our experiences at work, the pandemic in its nature is stressful, and how people relate to their jobs during and post, and, you know, the great walkout or whatever, right? Like, how, you know, people suddenly are like, there are other ways in which I can have a working life. And I feel like it's been really challenging because I think people who are on the front end of the activism side of it, they were sort of dealing with things left and right. An orchestra is like any other workplace in that it can be a microcosm of society. And so you have people who have great diversity of beliefs, and somehow we have to come together to have a policy that is going to work for the majority of people. And that's really challenging. And so it's been something where I do see both sides, but that doesn't mean that I am necessarily, and by both sides, I mean, I can sort of see both sides of any situation. Just because I can see it doesn't mean I agree with it. But at least I'm saying, all right, I acknowledge your position one way or another, but here's maybe another way to consider this. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's something that I'm good at doing.
that's pretty much what I meant by you see both sides, you feel empathy. And for someone like myself, I don't always, if something riles me, the way somebody says something, you know, my natural inclination is to sort of like shut down and say, well, they're stupid and they're wrong.
Well, and I mean, I think in doing this kind of work, at the end of the day, if one considers oneself simply a member of something bigger, and that at the end of the day, most people are going to want a better workplace, and it isn't just exclusive to our industry or our I hate to call it an industry, but to a certain extent it is. When the disability insurance ended, I took a desk job at a hospital here in Chicago, and it was sort of the same kinds of things in which, you know, we had the people who they wanted to provide great care for their patients. And so it's the same kind of thing that even when some people who felt this policy would be different or this way of doing it is better, or, and you know how hospitals are, right? So like it was, but at the end of the day, I mean, then everyone that I worked with at that hospital wanted to be patient focused. And so for musicians and orchestra, and I find this to be true that as I'm working with different groups, it's like, you know, everyone wants the best for their workplace and their colleagues, and they want to go to work and feel good about it. So it's just getting everyone lined up to know that that's what we want, and just that we have to work together through the pitfalls of how we get there.
The last question I asked Adam was about some of the other self-care things he discovered during the pandemic that have carried through to the present. Now, I knew Adam had a love for fountain pens because he shared and infected me with this ink love when he was still living in Sarasota. We could spend hours going over our ink, pen and paper collections, treasuring and trading them like baseball cards. And he discovered something quite powerful during the pandemic while exploring the craft of putting pen to paper.
I found, as I was kind of cleaning out a drawer, I found a fountain pen that I bought, like 20 years ago. And I said, I know I should really like find ink and do something with it. And then I went to the art and supply store in Sarasota, and they ended up having, in addition to inks, they had like various different pens, including the wonderful and inexpensive Platinum Preppy. And I picked one up and I was like, whoa, this is just awesome. And it kind of started down the rabbit hole of it's like writing with these is a real, you know, it's a way to look away from the screen. And I think in some ways, especially during the pandemic, while we were to the earlier point that, okay, so online interactions became so necessary, but it also, there's a bit of a distortion whenever there's anything you're viewing online. I mean, one can create their persona on Facebook, and if that's all you see, that's all you know. So I started, partly as a way of self-care, this is largely, again, like influenced by you when you gave me that dot journaling book. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. And I started doing it, and then I set it aside, and then I picked it up again and then set it aside. And then I said, well, now that my fountain pen collection is growing, I should like put it to good use and start like really doing it. The biggest thing for me, I mean, and I think artists or musicians, I think really any artist gets the type A, you know, you have to be perfect. It has to, like, everything we do has to have this level of perfection. I think it's maybe more of a situation for orchestral musicians because of our audition process and the way that we're taught, and we're rarely allowed to make mistakes. You know, I always say that in baseball, a 350 average is an amazing career, and a 350 average for a symphony musician gets you fired on the first day. And so I think that part of that, what the journaling did was, and doing it in ink, not in pencil, was that it was a visual reminder that starting to do it and not worrying about making a mistake was huge. So you made a mistake, like it's your journal, or you're the only one who's going to read it. So what does, you're not writing for posterity. It's like, it's just, so just start in any way, like make lists. Like it doesn't have to be interesting. It just has to serve a purpose for you. And so once I kind of released the idea that like, because a lot of those dot journaling websites and books are, you know, they have these elaborate and beautiful, gorgeous like calligraphy and writing, and I'm like, well, yeah, that's so to the extent that it's like, yeah, it's not going to look like that, but who cares? Like, you know, and yeah, you're going to screw it up a lot, and who cares? You know, it's allowed this having the freedom to be creative without the fear. And it's something, actually, if I can like kind of circle back a little bit to music. This was the first time that I actually, I think, really got, by that I mean, like, I really understood viscerally something that Michael Tilson Thomas said to me at New World when I was a fellow at the New World Symphony. So I was assigned principal oboe for Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony, which has a very famous, beautiful solo that opens the second movement. And I had practiced it 19 different ways from Sunday to get every possible thing that I wanted out of that solo, and every plan and everything that I want. I played it for like 10 different people, and, you know, took this aggregate of comments, and who knew that one could like get so wrapped up in, you know, 30 measures or something like that. Like it's, but we do, that's what we do as musicians. So, musicians played in symphony orchestras. And so I started, we were at the rehearsal, the first rehearsal, and we started the second movement, and I played four notes and I stopped. And an MTT said, why did you stop? And I said, because it wasn't legato from the D flat to the C, and the C stuck out of the line like I couldn't believe. And then by the time I got to the A, it was just a disaster and I had to stop. And everybody laughed, not as a combination of, Jesus, Adam, you're being ridiculous right now. And also with a bit of knowledge that, oh yeah, like this is exactly how I think about everything that I play. Like, right. Like everyone has, I'm sure that 90% that maybe even conservative musicians, symphony musicians have this like inner critic that never shuts up.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So we had a good chuckle about it, everybody, including MTC. And he said, okay, so it didn't go according to plan. What if you just played it? And why not keep yourself open to the fact that maybe what comes out, even though it may not have been according to your plan, what if it would have been better than your plan? And what if you could have created something new with it and allow yourself the opportunity that through what you may, I'm paraphrasing, he didn't say this, but like what you perceive as a mistake to be something that creates something new. And then he continued to say, all we're doing here, we're your accompanists. It's just, there's just pizzicatos happening and I will follow you. You just play it and see what you can turn it into, even if it doesn't go according to your plan. That was one of the greatest gifts that I've ever received as a musician from conductor. It was really kind of mind blowing at the time to me then. And so sure enough, like, I played it and I was like, okay, yeah, it, why not? Okay. So this came out this way and it made me, it sort of centered me in listening to what I was doing in the moment and not worried about whether it had come out the way I planned it to come out. And it was really a wonderful gift to sort of allow myself to be in the moment. And funny enough, like inadvertently gave him a picture of my psychology because probably 3 months later, we were doing Mahler 4, and there's the lovely third movement. There's a set toward the first third of it. The oboe begins with this very beautiful line, and so I just started the D, and instantly my inner critic like went to town. It's like, ugh, that's sharp. It's no vibrato. Tone sounds like crap. And so I mean, like within like second, like a nanosecond, like all this is going on. An MTT, he's moving his hand. As he's conducting, he's moving his free hand in a motion as to say, come on. And he said, and he goes, come on, Adam, sounds great. And I was like, oh, I but I think about that a lot. I mean, I tell that story to my students, but I also, I think even like now that I think about it and like how that relates to what one thinks of as a mistake and how that can turn into something different that maybe you never conceived of before. So, you know, turning away from the oboe and into other things, like mistakes are essential to creativity, and having that awareness, like particularly now, is something that I look back on that moment and I think, oh yeah, like I get it a little more now maybe than even I did then. Yeah. It's sort of like another thing when Sarah Vaughan, when she was doing a show with Marion McPartland for piano jazz, and she played a few times and sang a few times. And there's a wonderful moment where they're doing East of the Sun and West of the Moon. And she starts singing toward the end of the tune and she kind of went off, and then it did. And it went off in some direction that she didn't like. And she instantly just said, oh, I was trying to be creative and it's not working. And then continued on going a different direction. And I was like, I just love that. Like, yeah, okay. I'm trying to be, it's not working. I'm just going to try something else. And, you know, so I don't know. This is a weird like way to kind of, cause your question was about self-care, but I think that in doing the journaling made me think about all of this stuff that at the bottom line of the self-care is not worrying about mistakes.
Since Adam was one of the earliest guests on the podcast, and also early in his transition into his work as a union negotiator, I wanted to check back in with him, perhaps mistakenly, to look for a bookend or to close the circle. that his change in careers had just become this technicolor explosion of new experiences, new people, and new perspectives. And thankfully, Adam reminded me of some of the basic tenets of resilience. We don't go through tempering in order to become new and different. We temper in order to become stronger and stronger versions of ourselves. Do you feel like you're kind of finding your way or finding a new path?
I wouldn't say it's new.
Okay.
Is that weird? I don't know. I don't think
it's not.
Yeah, I don't think it's new. Even when I took this job, I thought, well, it's kind of a bit of a continuation of what I have been doing. Granted, in a slightly different role, and with each kind of step along the way, it's almost kind of to your earlier point about, like, as you involve more people or you start to gain perspectives, you know, I mean, I sort of had my Southwest Florida perspective, having just worked amongst our own colleagues in Sarasota and Tampa Bay area for over a decade. And then to kind of get into, you know, other people where they are and other orchestras and where they are. And I think to that end, yeah, it's been a really, it's just been really fascinating to look at sort of these different perspectives and then kind of integrate them into each experience each orchestra that I work with, you know. It's, and I think that's called, you know, that's like anything else, you know, you conductor comes in and says, I want to do it this way. You say, oh, I've never really done it that way before, but sure, I'll go there. And then you do, and there's a freshness or something that enters your mind as you play it that you hadn't considered previously. And then it becomes part of your own way of playing that piece. I think that's life. It's kind of similar in anything. It doesn't, you know, people take that kind of energy into their own work, whatever it is. So
how are you with the Meniere's? Where are you with that now?
Yeah, it's status quo, which is good news. There's a drug trial. So I'm trying to get into the drug trial. I'm working with my doctors on that. But so I think in the beginning it was easy to sort of despair and, you know, think, well, okay, this is just the way it is. But, you know, now I think I'm a bit more, I feel a bit more empowered to keep searching for solutions and not just necessarily augmentation solutions, but as the technology and the knowledge start to become greater, more sophisticated, I think I still hold out hope that we're going to see some major advancements. It was always such a part of my life and that it was not something to be exchanged, right? Or so it isn't as if like I'm on this new path and now therefore it's like I leave the old path behind. Like I couldn't do that. And I don't know, maybe if I had had a, you know, a total loss, it may have been different. But even then, I don't know if I would have had to figure out some way to sort of still connect. I think because, you know, when one goes through this career or life or, you know, vocation, you have so much of it that's part of you and it's hard to leave it. And, you know, when I was interviewing for this job, I had a really nice interview with Ray Hare and the president of the AFM and Jay Blumenthal, who's the secretary treasurer, and then Rochelle Skolnick, the council, the president and the director of symphonic services for the Federation. And so as we talked about this a little bit, and Ray stopped me, he said, Adam, you are still a musician. Don't you ever forget that. Ray knew just what to say and when to say it. So
thank you for joining us on Mission Artist. Our guest today was musician and American Federation of Musicians negotiator Adam DeSorgo. If you'd like to learn more about our guests and our mission, you can log on to missionartist.org or hear us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Podbean.